Aloha, everybody, and welcome to another Candid Conversation. Today, we're joined by Chris Wilmot, who, just as we got ready for this discussion, called this chat Two Old Men Talking. And unfortunately, I resemble that remark. Chris, welcome aboard. Good to see you.
Hey, Ron. Good morning. How's the sun shining in Hawaii this morning?
Well, it's wonderful. Chris and I are bookmarks. He's in Florida and I'm in Hawaii. So, you know, we have an interesting situation going right now where both of us have nice weather and in good locations near water, which I love. Chris, I'm nearly 75, and I think you're somewhere close behind me. And both of us started in the industry rather early. I think I was 69 and you were 70.
Right.
And you've had a long and varied history. I taught tennis and swimming. You taught golf. How the heck did you get started in this game?
Well, Ron, I'll tell you, if you had asked me early on, did I ever have any interest in selling or repairing bulldozers or wheel loaders or motor graders, I would have told you I didn't even know what one was. And so I never woke up like many kids that grew up that way, thinking about being in the heavy equipment business. I was a golf professional up in Washington and ended up getting married. And my father-in-law said, you know, my wife requires to eat every day and golf professionals don't make very much jingle. Can I help you get a job? And it hit me at the right time. So I got out of the business and I started with a company in Charlotte in a program that they started with me. I was the alpha test case, and that was a new management training program. And my first job was in the parts warehouse. So it was interesting showing up in white shoes and a cashmere sweater the first day. I learned that neither one of those worked very well in the parts warehouse. So that's how I got started. And I've been in distribution most of my life, but I spent 8 years with a manufacturer running a dealer. I was their dealer development manager for the U.S. And I traveled around the U.S. putting together their dealer network and making changes where I had to and improving where I needed to. And and then I started a dealership in Florida for the company that I started with, L.B. Smith. I started a dealership in a hotel room in Florida, one person, when I had no idea what I was doing. I probably ended my career the same way, not much idea what I was doing. But we hired good people, and we always put the customer first and our employees 1A, 1B, and we ended up pretty successful, Ron.
Yeah, no, that's very true. You've made quite a mark. L.B. Smith had franchises up and down the East Coast, and today doesn't exist anymore.
It's the nature of our business, you know. And you and I have been talking about this subject for at least 20 years periodically, is the undercapitalized distribution network. Our dealers don't have enough net worth to do the things that they need to do. They either have too small a territory or in some cases too large a territory. They, the responsibility shift where manufacturers shift the responsibility to dealers and then customers shift it up to dealers, and dealers are in the middle in our industry, you know, and then you take like the rental business, for example, and it takes money to be in the rental business. And manufacturer says, yeah, I don't have a program for you to to have the machines, but I need you to have 50 RTEC trucks in just your rental fleet. Well, that takes capital. That takes net worth to put together rental fleets. And so dealers are caught in the middle, in my view, and I think the industry view, and it's a never-ending issue. And so until dealers can figure out a way, non-CAT dealers, I'll say, non-CAT dealers can figure out a way to increase their balance sheet, it's going to be always a question of, do I have the assets, you know, to take care of my customer? Yeah. And it's a tough situation. So you take a company like L.B. Smith that started in 1916, at one time had 16, they were in 16 states, and they were one of the first companies to break, I mean, back in the 70s, to break that magical $100 million revenue number. Now, you know, small little companies representing an import excavator can have that kind of revenue. So
it sure changed, doesn't it?
It has changed a lot.
You know, one of the things that, you know, capital is kind of the barrier to entry in this construction equipment market business. And that's true around the world. And what I find really astounding is Caterpillar is today the only manufacturer whose dealers are all privately owned. Every other manufacturer owns a lot of the dealers.
Caterpillar has the answer to the question. And CAT has, because of how successful they have been and how the CAT manufacturer, in my view, has helped dealers transition their business to a parts and service supported business where there is chance of margin. CAT has helped dealers become very profitable. And because of that, you know, they don't own the dealers, but they have a major share of their mind. And our CAT is purely focused on, and CAT dealers are focused on what's best for Caterpillar. And I would be in the same position.
It's remarkable. I started in CAT dealers and spent the first 13 years, I guess, of my life in this industry with two Caterpillar dealers, one in Quebec in Canada, the other in British Columbia. And in the early years, the chairman of Caterpillar's name was Bill Blackie. And I had the opportunity to meet Mr. Blackie in Montreal. He was up visiting dealers. And this is a guy who put himself through school by delivering milk behind a horse or in a horse-drawn wagon in Peoria. He was a little Scot, so he's frugal as heck, and didn't mince words. But what he did was created a Partsgram, which was a book that had every process and procedure known to the parts business documented. This is how you do it. He did the same thing with the service department. Caterpillar, when they started, created a chart of accounts. And what you mentioned, that Caterpillar has share of the dealer's mind, where I don't think there's a Caterpillar dealer in the world that I've run into that has as much as 10% of their business that's not Caterpillar.
Exactly.
And that makes life so much easier to do, to operate, to work, to be unbelievable. I offered Mr. Blackie my services. You'll laugh at this. I think it was late 69, maybe 70. I said, I'd like to come work for you if I could, because I have a lot to learn and I think I could learn a lot from you. He was a really impressive guy. And I think in those days I was making $400 a month, Canadian. although maybe the Canadian dollar was more valuable in those days than the US dollar. But he looked at me, Chris, and you're going to laugh at this. He said, "Ron, I don't think there's much I can teach you." This guy was maybe up to my middle of my chest. He was so short. He said, "Besides which, don't you think $400 a month is a little rich?" He was quite a man, but he laid the foundation. He's the guy that created the absorption formula.
Well, and see, therein lies the magical wand for distribution.
No question,
is absorption. It's when there, I've been kind of retired now for about 10, 12 years, and I've done some stints in consulting. And one of them, I worked with a Freightliner off the road truck dealer.
Right.
And it's amazing how their business is structured in a similar business is structured as opposed to the heavy construction industry. A off the road truck dealer is turning his parts 8 to 10 times a year. A heavy equipment dealer, a good one, is what, 3.7, 3.8 turns a year on? In that range, a good one is. And so you just look at the utilization of cash. You turning your inventory means you better have a pretty sophisticated ERP system to control your inventory, know how to order. But it's taking, if you have $8 million worth of parts inventory and you turn it 8 times, you're doing $64 million worth of business, and look at the margin that you have been able to put together. And then you add the service to support it. And this truck dealer that I was working with had 138% absorption.
Yep.
And this was in like 2010 or 11 when I was with him, when everyone else was laying off people and going through it. Those truck dealers, if they were hurting, it's because they couldn't get product.
Yeah.
And they couldn't get anything to sell. But that takes a long time to develop a model like that as well. But it's absorption is the key to industry profitability.
Yeah. I like to label us the capital goods industry. So I'm going to include automotive. I'm going to include on a highway truck. I'm going to include engine. I'm going to include motorcycles, material handling, marine, a whole host of different things. And all of them but us, all of them except the construction equipment group, has had a business-altering experience that's provoked and forced them to change how they do things. The on-highway truck Freightliner, PACCAR, which owns Peterbilt and Kenworth.
Right.
A partner of mine, his name was Mac Ferries. We started a company for 20 groups called Insight. And Mac did the same thing with the on-highway truck business. And he used to tell a story, and it's all part and parcel of the same discussion, that PACCAR reimbursed the dealers for warranty at the cost of the parts and about 70% of the published labor rate. And he said to the company, he was vice president of dealer development for them, and he said, "Look, we sell a truck to a guy. He has a warranty failure in the first 90 days for some strange reason. And our dealers are busy satisfying customer needs where they make money. And as a result of that, our warranty is at the back of the line. It makes our brand look terrible." He said, "I want to reimburse everybody at customer rates." And he was successful in making that happen. And then all of a sudden, the dealerships put warranty at the front of the line. Material handling went through a horrible period of time. Today, they may make 4, 6, 8% margin on a machine. They had to make money on parts and service and rentals. The rental business comes in. If you look at the landscape, there's hardly any large dealer, private dealer rental fleets. The only ones I can think of are primarily Caterpillar. Everybody else, Hertz, Sunbelt, SunState, United, they're all, for the most part, publicly traded companies.
Right.
And
someone else's money.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And your comment earlier on, I was talking with a pretty senior executive at one of the manufacturers recently. He says, we're going through another phase where the manufacturers are forcing the dealers to come to the table with more money because the manufacturer is not going to pay it anymore. And we're at another phase where the customers are using, they don't want to use their money at all.
Well,
they're going to use the dealer's money.
And so it's all shifted to the guy making the smallest margin, the guy making the smallest margin in the middle, and that is distribution.
Yep.
Taking most of the risk.
And that's why we're seeing the consolidation we're seeing in North America.
Exactly.
It's really an interesting, however, as you know, and as I know, there's a whole host of ways we can make money and make changes, but people are really slow to adapt and change, aren't they?
Well, they are. And, Ron, I've thought a lot about through the years about things to do different. And I have a little, this is not self-serving, but I have a little consulting business. It's not very active because I'm not promoting it. But I always said to my customers, if I can't help you, don't pay me. And I know people don't want to hear that, but dealers almost have to be kind of you know, we're caught in the middle a little bit. And you think about technology and how that's changed, and you think about ERP networks that many dealers have moved to that kind of gives you the instant balancing of your inventory and balance sheets, and they have BIs and tacked to them and everything. But the whole, I'm talking circles a little bit, I apologize, but the real deal is when you take your eyes off the customer, when you take customer satisfaction out of your equation, I think customer satisfaction is the only way to guarantee you profitability.
I couldn't agree with you more. And the other thing that's become interesting over the last, since January of 2020, with all of the disruptions that this terrible pandemic has created, a lot of customers have been left behind because companies are seriously trying to survive.
So what does that mean? That means they lower their parts inventory.
Yep.
So they rely only on the manufacturer, which means their back order recovery goes from 1 or 2 days to 10 days. So a customer buys 10 40-ton Arctic trucks from you, two of them are down, and it takes 10 days to get a part. He's losing 8,000 yards a day in payload pay. And so, 80,000 times whatever his bid number is, he's losing money because the dealer's in the middle and can't stock the parts.
That's right.
And exactly what you've said, same way like service.
Yep.
So you go and a manufacturer cuts a dealer on a national account deal where he gets, to your point, less than 100% for parts and service, and has a service requirement that they have to respond the very first day to this national account. And then as good paying customers get pushed aside.
Yep.
It has to be a partnership, and they have to, and that's the reason the Cat dealers are so wonderfully profitable and great because the manufacturer has helped the dealers understand, if I'm going to grow, I'm going to have your share of mind, and yeah, you're only going to be thinking about us.
Yeah, it's interesting. As you know, I've done work all around the world, consulting and training and teaching, but in Europe, other than Caterpillar, I can think of maybe five private money-owned dealerships out of all the remaining brands. You go to Asia, it's worse. South America, it's worse. It's really a strange circumstance. So if I'm Caterpillar, I don't want anything to change.
Absolutely not.
You know?
Absolutely not.
And if I'm others, and, you know, in the large equipment, mining equipment, today there's primarily just two manufacturers left. One's Caterpillar, the other's Komatsu. Almost everybody else has fallen by the wayside. Then in the middle size.
Is it the price of entry? Is it just take way too much investment to get in it?
Well, I think that's part of it. But what's also interesting, Chris, at least from my perspective, there's maybe eight major mining customers in the world.
There you go.
And they can pretty well demand, not dictate, but demand. And they get from Caterpillar because they have the money. And they don't get from many others. Deere is not making big enough equipment.
Right.
Doosan Infracord, they don't make big enough equipment. Volvo, Hitachi, they don't make big enough equipment. Hitachi's got some heavy-duty shovels.
And Lee Bear in some areas has some equipment, but it's very sporadic.
So if you're an operator and you want a single point of responsibility, you really only have one of two choices. Then you come down to the next level. Let me call it middle-sized equipment. And now we got the world. We got Komatsu. We got Caterpillar. Right. We got Volvo. We got Deere. We got Case. We got Hitachi. We got a whole host of people trying to differentiate themselves. And that's getting harder. And now, coming out of the pandemic, supply chain issues are becoming really serious. So that 2 days to 10 days you talked about, now it might be 45 days.
Right.
And Lord love you, if you've got a major account and he needs a truck running and he's losing.
Right.
Holy mackerel, baby. You better, you know.
You better load one up, boy.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, there's customer retention, customer loyalty, paying a customer to customers has long been a metric of mine. And with AED, when I was writing monthly columns and we were doing 5-year surveys, 15% of the service customers defected, not going up or down, but going away, stopping buying from service departments. Now, if you take that out 5 years, that's the end of all your customers.
Is that because the cost was too high? Or they didn't get what they paid for, machines. I mean, there's a lot of reasons for that. Machines become more component exchanges. Repairs are more component exchanges instead of parts exchange. I mean, there has to be a number of common reasons for that.
But you're going to love this. The main one is responsiveness. The customer call the dealership. I can't get to you for 3 to 5, 7 days.
Okay, so it comes back to the human issue, doesn't it, Ron?
Yes, sir. Always does.
Okay, so you know, I had a guy that I worked with, and you know him real well, but we sat and reorganized 1 year, exactly what you said, our whole service issue. And we gave probably one of your tests, but we gave every mechanic a baseline test to see what they knew.
Yeah.
It was probably one of your tests. And a matter of fact, I think it was. And so then we put put service people in different categories, journeyman, beginning technician, master mechanic, so on. I think there were four categories. And then we tied a pay scale to that category. And it just wasn't based on longevity, is what you know and how much you can earn for us.
Exactly.
And then we started paying people to go to extra schools for us. And we gave you an increase in pay if you took this much training. And I think back then there was a number floating around the industry, and maybe you're responsible for it, is that 3% of your total labor hours all be tied up in training. Well, that's pretty expensive, but you know, but it's also, you can't afford not to do it. And, yeah. And then we went to all of the major tech schools in Florida, and we devised a program with them, actually gave money or gave them exchanges, an engine transmission or an axle, one that we had, we loaned it to them for them to train on. And in return, we got an opportunity to hire their first or second graduating guy from their class, just to try to find techs. But yeah, it's going to be a much bigger issue going forward. People would rather work on a computer for $28 or $30 an hour instead of working in the sun for the same price.
Yeah,
no, I think
it's amazing. In my early years, I used to teach at the technical schools. I used to teach at university, but the reason that I did that was for exactly what you're talking about. I used to go in and say, look, I'll take a class on. I'll bring another guy in. He'll take a class on. But I want to have first dibs at all your graduates.
Right.
And they would give that to me. So away we'd go. Ed Gordon's a fellow that is another guest on these Candid Conversations. We're publishing him in May. He's a professor at Northwestern, a couple of PhDs, one of these hateful guys that's really smart.
Yeah.
And he's saying, you know, you got companies today, they're hiring people and figure that they don't have to train them because they're hiring their skills and that's the end of that. And you got employees today that when they leave school, figure, my learning's over, I'll just go get a job and keep on going. Both positions are dead wrong. We're in a lifelong learning world now, yeah, with the rate of change and everything, technology and everything around us. My goodness, I can't imagine somebody leaving school at whatever level, high school, technical school, university, graduate degree, whatever, and figuring, well, that's it. I don't need to crack another book. I don't need to take another class. I know everything I need to know. Can you imagine that perception?
I can't imagine it. Not to do a infomercial for what you have done most of your life, but training in this industry, and not just sales training, but you have focused on operational excellence in the parts and service department. And you know, when you look it up, Ron, your name pretty much stands by itself. The rest of the trainers, they're all over here in sales. I mean, there's more cookie sheet stuff, but when it comes down to operational, to attack the hard issues, you know, there's not many out there that want to do that.
No, it's really funny. I was talking to someone this morning earlier. I said, you know, I used to be like a mule braying in a tin barn. I make a lot of noise, but not a lot of people are paying attention. Parts and service has been the back room. You know, it's, and you and I both know that that's the key to successful dealerships. You know, you talked earlier about turnover. And I use a measure called return on capital employed. So I'm looking at the gross profit, not the net profit, so that we're just dealing with pricing and asset management. And if you turn your inventory four times, and you have a gross profit of 25%, you get 100% return on your investment in your inventory.
Correct.
So
if you turn it eight times, you get 200%.
Well, let's do something a little differently. Let's say that market share is our target, and I want to reduce my price so that I have 20% gross margin, not 25. In order for me to have 100% return on my inventory, I have to turn my inventory five times. So if you look at inventory turnover as one of your price tools, you can get more traction with more people, but that requires, I hate to say it this way, a little bit of thinking. If market share, if you look at over my 50 years and your 50 years in this business, our parts market share has halved. Whether you're Caterpillar, Komatsu, Deere, Case, Volvo, anybody, it's gone down by 50%. And it's obvious as to the reasons. The internet has given us access to all manner of suppliers all around the world. So I know
and to your point, a buyer now for a large paving company, say, or a big rock quarry, they have professional parts buyers, professional buyers that buy all kinds of things from paper towels in the shop supplies to axles and engine transmissions. And they, to your point, and the reason why parts and service or dealers are losing business, this guy sits in his office and calls 10 Volvo dealers in the Southeast or up through Maine, if you're in Florida, and he's shopping prices. And somebody will always sell it to him cheaper than the price he has.
Yep.
But then it's hard to capture the rest of it. And see, this is where dealers fall down. If they lose that business and the rebuild engine fails, who are they going to call? They aren't going. They're going to try to call the local dealer, not the dealer in Maine they bought it from.
Yep.
And so this is where I go back to. A dealer has to be focused on customer satisfaction.
Yep.
You know, does anything aggravate you more when you call a business and you get a rototel computer answering and press 3 and you try to do that 4 or 5 times and then you get a voicemail? You're trying to call a guy to order a part and nobody answers the phone. And you get Jim's voicemail and he says he promises he'll call you back. It's tough to live with. It's tough for me to live with.
It's almost impossible for anybody to live with.
And yet more and more and more dealers, I mean, I've had are going to that. They want to save the $15 an hour of a person answering the phone. However, if they had, and many, many operational systems now have these, you call your business, and when that phone number hits the screen, it populates immediately with Ron Slee Construction Company, your address, your branch addresses, your shop numbers, and right below it, it starts populating
their equipment list,
your equipment list, and your purchasing habits, and the whole nine yards. So a guy calls up and says, and you transfer him to the parts department, and the guy answers the parts, and he said, "Hey Jim, this is Ron. I need some filters for my 120." The guy's smart enough to say, "Hey, is that 61245?" He said, "Yes." He said, "I got them. Do you want to pick them up or do you want me to ship them?" And yep. The call, instead of taking 30 minutes to look up a serial number and what the parts goes with it, he's done. So those little technology advances are focused on customer satisfaction and improving the quality of service. And in every case, people will pay for better service. Well, people will pay for better quality.
Yeah, and I call that value, providing value to your customers.
It is value.
You know.
And yet, we're slow to adapt to some of those things. The big guys are. I bet CAT has all those systems.
Well, in fact, they don't, but that's part of the dilemma. Until CAT is forced to do that kind of thing, nobody's going to do it. So somebody who's, it's kind of like the Coke and Pepsi challenge, you know, Coca-Cola has to confront the Pepsi challenge. Kleenex is almost a universal word for tissue. Kodak used to be a universal word for a camera. Today, the technology's there to be able to say, this is Chris Wilmot. The last time Chris called me was two months ago. So the first thing when I pick up the phone talking with you in that case is, Chris, great to hear from you. It's been a long time. Is everything okay? Now right. We're changing the whole gig. It's a relationship now.
It's a relationship model.
Exactly.
I'll tell you, if you're non-Caterpillar, you better have something to offset that big mammoth machine that they have. And they're going to have more parts. They're going to have more techs, but you can get share of wallet and share of mind and an opportunity to put your machine in there if you would help develop a culture of customer satisfaction with your customers.
Yeah, I agree with you.
And I'm going to tell you, Ron, it's going to even get tougher. Start integrating millennials in your system. And I'm not saying anything bad about younger people, but you and I get it a lot better because we had to work for a living. And our entitlement meant I was entitled to get a check on Friday if I worked 40 to 50 hours.
Yeah.
You know, it's a challenge for distribution.
Oh, it's big time a challenge. And I don't want anybody to misunderstand. I don't think you're saying this either. I have nothing but respect for how Caterpillar and their dealers have operated.
I do.
The millennials situation, it's kind of interesting. Our generation, I still have a landline.
I do too. I have one.
My daughter doesn't. They're just cell phones. Okay, so then let's use my daughter's generation. She's pushing up to 45 and my granddaughter's pushing up to 20. My granddaughter, 95% of her communications with her friends is on a text.
Correct.
It's not even a voice anymore. So, you know, I'm unbelievably in awe of the millennials and the whatever the tailgate generation is behind them. They've been taught, they have education. If they've taken advantage of it, they have more knowledge than we ever had coming out of school. So when they go to work, and you did this and I did this, why do you do things that way? I did that 50 years ago. And, you know, I teasingly have asked some of the guys that I worked with, was I hard to deal with? I wasn't hard to deal with, was I, Chris? Oh, come on. And they laugh because I was constantly pestering. Why the hell are we doing it this way? And now when the 25-year-olds come into the dealership and start asking those questions, I start going, yay. But their boss says, go away.
Right.
And we're blowing it big time. These younger people, we need them desperately. They change how we think about things. Our customers are run by millennials now, for goodness sake.
You're so very true. You're true.
We've got to adapt and adjust. We got to become Marines, you know. Whatever we see, adapt to it. Any magic bullets that you put across customer satisfaction, customer service is one of them. One of the things you and I talk about is there's a constrained gross profit, 20% maybe to 22%. We got to be really conscious of costs. One of the penalties I see to that is we've cut back on headcount. You're answering the telephone with a machine because I don't want to spend $15 an hour for an employee. I think we got to get back in the people business, not the systems business. Where's your head on that?
Well, I think that the systems are great, but you have to have a system that helps you provide customer service. It was just like the example we talked about 3 minutes ago about when the phone calls and when the phone rings and you and you have a matrix of information that puts you so much further ahead, that would be an investment that would that with training would give you a return.
Yep.
The hiring technical people and technical support, Ron, is going to be a huge challenge. And don't think that we aren't in for a real big issue if some kind of infrastructure bill is passed in Washington. Who is going to do the work? I'll give you an example. Right through the middle of Orlando, now there's a $2.7 billion, almost $3 billion private public funded I-4 job. It's 27 miles. It's almost a $3 billion project. What that has done is that has sucked up all the what I call miscellaneous or incidental labor. There's nobody you can hire to work on golf courses to cut grass. There's so many things in the workforce that were done by that type of labor group.
Yep.
that are not available, and it's going to be a continued issue. You know, you have to have people on the wash rack. You have to have people to unload and load low boys. You have to have people to work in the parts department warehouse. There's going to be a continued HR issue, and if senior management and distribution doesn't spend extra time thinking about how he's going to provide people to grow his company, you know, take a company and grow it from 75 to 125, and you had 50 people to do it. Boy, in the old days, when I started my dealership down here, I knew every single person.
Sure.
Because one of my pushes was to make sure we hired the right person. Well, as you grow, you lose control of that. But part of your culture needs to be having your managers that are trying to hire good, right people, honest people.
Yeah.
And it's going to be a continued challenge. It's going to be a real challenge. Not seem like a big deal, and it may seem like an internally focused project of something of working on your balance sheet. It's going to be your balance sheet.
The biggest challenge I see coming at us is people, period.
It's going to be people, and then training them.
Yep.
Then training them. What do you think dealers are spending now on training? Do you think they're spending 3% of their labor hours? I wouldn't think so.
No, and it's worse than that. The this Ed Gordon that I was referencing earlier has a series of things he's calling job shock, saying that we will probably lose, because of lack of labor, between $5 and $8 trillion of our GDP by 2030. And that's a pretty big number. And he goes further and he says the labor force is going to be split into three categories, basically a third, a third, a third. The top third are the educated people who are driven, ambitious, curious, working. They're going to be fine. The bottom third don't know what the hell's going on. They dropped out. They're undereducated and they don't have the jobs like you were just talking about. The middle third is trying to figure out what goes on. And business, whether it's small business, big business, government, whether it's education, whether it's the students, I think we're doing a poor job on helping kids in high school create a roadmap, a path where they can have some kind of career life that is meaningful for them. And I think everybody wants that. I don't care what your background is or whatever the demographic is. I hate all of that stuff. This is a group. It's a pool of people. And
you're talking about technical schools.
Everything.
Because not everybody wants to go to the University of Calgary or the University of Florida or Ontario State. You know, they don't want to be there.
That's right.
But they're good, productive people that that we could put to work and train them and enhance their life. But they're available. They are available.
You're so true. But before the pandemic, I think it was 2018, people were telling me it's really hard to find a service manager. And the discussion I would have is, well, where's the last one you created that you developed? Well, what are you talking about? They didn't do that. So I said, well, wait a second. You know, early in my career, we used to hire kids between their junior and senior year of university, whether it's undergraduate degree, a master's, it didn't matter what. And we'd bring them in for that 4 month, that management training that you went through. And I was typically the youngest manager in place. And I did this at Finning, and we'd have between 12 and 18 kids. And I'd put them in the warehouse for the first month, and I'd lose half of them. It's
right.
Too much like work doing that. You know, you're sweating, right. You get dirty.
Right.
I'm not going to do that. But after a number of years, you talk about culture, everybody in the company in management and supervision and sales had come into the company with that program. It was remarkably powerful. I think we got to get back to that. And we got to get back to that quickly. It's coming up to spring. Summer vacation for kids is coming up on us for those that don't go to summer school. Hire them. Create a pool that next year, if they get their degree, they've got a job. In 18, 19, why I started this is mechanical engineers in 2018, the unemployment rate for first-year graduates, 50%. So we used to hire mechanical engineers as assistant service managers. Let's go. Life is simple, Chris. It's people.
Right. It's not complicated. And, you know, you have to ingrain the whole culture through your companies, you know, little simple things like you have to have a fair health insurance program that meets all your customers' needs.
Yep.
You don't want to lose your best mechanic for 50 cents an hour to the Komatsu dealer.
Yep.
You know, you want to build a base around him. Yeah, you have to make continuing education a part of your culture. It has to be good people want to grow. They want to expand and they want to have the answers. It's just a culture of developing in a dealership. Like we used to do it 25 years ago.
Yep.
And I'm afraid we have lost some of those because it's so internally focused on every single penny. And maybe that's easier to say than do. But I think guys like you and I could do it.
Well, the other side of that is that's a good place to stop because that's a springboard for another chat like this. Thanks so much, Chris. I think this has been valuable that you share your wisdom with the marketplace, with people who are caring. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have.
I have, Ron. Thank you.
Well, thank you, I appreciate it. Thank you, my friend. And I'm going to close this thing up telling everybody thank you for listening. And we look forward to talking to you soon at another of the Candid Conversations.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. We appreciate your support. Should you have any thoughts or comments, please don't hesitate to contact us at www.learningwithoutscars.com. The time is now. Mahalo.